You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Sulfurblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Gordon Lish, also sometimes a.k.a. Captain Fiction. He is the author most recently of Zim Zum, published by Pantheon. My personal favorite of his books is Extravaganza, which is nowadays available in an edition from White Pine Press. He's the author as well of two books of short stories and three other novels. I thought I'd begin. It seems to me that I know the word Zim Zum from Harold Bloom's book Kabbalah and Criticism. Am I right?
I think that's to identify the very source that I know it from, Michael, yes.
What does it mean?
Well, I think if you put the question to a host of persons who have scholarship in this zone, they would probably offer up variant responses. My own notion is that the creator, creative demon in my own case undergoes a kind of contraction, removing himself or leeching himself out of the void or out of the space in order to create room for the exterior world. And I think it's in this very private sense that I titled the book Zim Zum. I had a notion, too, that the word would serve as a suggestion of the buzz of the business of our standing in, as appliances to one another. There was in an early permutation of the book some reference to this, to the acoustical character of the word. But I think scholarship would have it largely that Zim Zum is the spasm, if you will, that the Godhead undergoes in order to create room for everything else that exists.
So it's a kind of mitosis, a pulling in order to expand out.
I think so. For me, yes. I think that in the enlarged sense that I hope to achieve of it in this book, it also concerned The undercurrent, if you will, of distractedness that necessarily attends our acts in life for us to manage the burden of consciousness, that we sort of remove ourselves from the present in a way to suffer the burden of consciousness.
Well, it seems as if in all of these books there's a kind of vestigial Gordon Lish who, for instance, Smith and Dale make mention of in Extravaganza. And here, it's as if Gordon sometimes is a creature, but he is as well, it seems, a sometime tenant of an insane asylum, and sometimes, how to put it, he seems divided between his duties as a son to aging parents, as a husband to an ill wife, as a lover to an argumentative and sullen mistress. But he seems not to have enough of himself to fulfill any two of these three at once.
You're the wisest reader, Michael. You embarrass me with your insight into the text. What you have before you is a vestigial Gordon Lish. I don't feel myself quite sufficient for the business of answering any of life's tasks, and it seems to me quite satisfactory when on the page to give away all of myself in the composition of a sentence, what the sentence points to. That is directly referential to any of its parts, I see as overcoming me, as certainly an object much lordlier and more antagonistic than I can quite bear to bring myself to overcome. I'm in flight from the objects that I write about. and would prefer seeing that the only object at hand that is at all genial, and of course indeed it's not really genial, it's probably at the bottom more hostile than any, is language itself.
Well, the Gordon in these books seems to want to be crazy. Is there any limit to how crazy he wants to be?
None. Not at all, no. I think crazy as a defense against its opposite.
And yet the Gordon in the world, at least the world I know, I think I first found him as the editor of an anthology called All Our Secrets Are the Same. Is that you or Russ Tills?
No, that was me. And preceding it was another anthology which collected...
The Secret Life of Our...
The Secret Life of Our Times. And these were stories I produced as an editor while at Esquire magazine. My tenure there was about 8 years. And I think these anthologies, the two you've remarked, represent a kind of... prefatory act to the sort that was achieved eventually in the publishing of the Quarterly.
Yes, and the editor of Quarterly, which Vintage was publishing as a paperback magazine, and an editor as well at Knopf. I keep imagining you as being someone who's managed to fool Knopf into publishing even more extreme writers than the Europeans they tend toward, to have managed to finagle Vintage into the publication of Q. And this, it seems to me, takes wiliness and sanity. Is insanity a mask?
Finagling, I think, is the very word. My life has, it seems to me, been lived in the enemy camp, and I hope always to review my accomplishments in that respect as successes. But in each instance, of course, I'm eventually found out, run out, drummed out, as I have been in effect with the Quarterly. We produced at Vintage 25 numbers. In no wise were any of them consistent, I expect, with the interests of Random House, and this pleased me greatly. But I'm sorry to see these activities come to an end. Does it take, I think the question you put to me, kind of supernal sanity to manage these divagations and subversions? I don't think so. I think it may prove to be that I've so perplexed my seniors that I disarm them somewhat. There is a gambit, doubtless you know, of pretending... an antic style, and therefore, for the time being, befuddling the adversary, and at least for so long as you're able to achieve that end, making off with his purse. It's something like that.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, there is, in addition to Zimzum, the contraction of God, that point where God overflows and explodes the vessels. And this would seem to be the poles between which you oscillate.
You're pointing directly to Harold Bloom's lovely phrase, Roan the Sacred Vessels, one of the greatest books, I think, ever produced by an American thinker. I think it's important always to undertake the task of making new. I think if one can, and I don't mean making new in the sense that Pound meant it exactly, but rather in a special sense of making it private. The only new I can make, given my limitations, is to extrude from my quiddity what I am uniquely. I think this is the task for each one of us as writers or as editors, so that making it new for me is really to decoct from some inward place that which is crucially myself. In so doing, one ruins the sacred vessels. One deposits himself in a place where there is no hospitality for what one is. Eventually, this act of destruction, this act of subversion, as I've been remarking earlier, is discovered, and one must make off to a setting where he can do his business again. Presumably, one continues to do this until the last of his days, if one is lucky.
I'm curious. When I first started to read Thomas Bernhardt, he was pointed out to me by Donald Barthelme, and I notice, of course, that you have an epigraph from Bernhardt at the beginning of this book. I had in the earlier years a problem with Bernhardt because he seemed so much to come from Beckett. And he seemed, at least in English, Beckett's syntactic inferior. I'm curious, much of the work, say, in Q, and your own work as well, comes from the monologic Beckett-Bernhardt fold. When do you know whether the vessels are being broken or just being filled again?
Yes, a lovely question, Michael. I think you don't know. I think the task before anyone who characterizes his program as creative is to struggle in every kind of way to escape that which formed him. There is no escaping the assertion that I have read Beckett, if not widely, at least perhaps too well. Too well in the sense that I have let him overcome me in certain kinds of ways. It is important, I think, to cite another principle proclaimed by Bloom, to do what we can to read only strong poets, and the strongest poet must be oneself, and not to read any other strong poets is probably seen as a great grace. I have not read Beckett, really, I suppose, for 25 years, and that scarcely suffices to produce sufficient gap in my reading to give me full enough escape from Beckett. The power he had over me when I was a younger man was colossal. But there are so few who exert such power. I quite agree with you. Syntactically, Beckett is no match for Bernhardt, no matter how Bernhardt, I think, is translated. I reversed that. I meant to say precisely the opposite. Bernhardt, who is really to be understood as Beckett's successor, is no match for Beckett, and that's unforgivable. One must, if one is standing on the shoulder of a giant, see farther than that giant was able to see. I imagine that the prospect of what writing there is before me, I've just finished a novel, that is to say, I've written a version of it and expect I will write several more before it is in fact print. I imagine the prospect before me is to continue to struggle to escape everything that was the case. How one suffers to do this without imposing on oneself a kind of destabilizing of the personality so significant that one cannot manage the exterior world anymore is the problem at hand. I have, and I don't mean this in romantic terms, taken writing rather too seriously in my life. I suit the Jamesian insult of Flaubert in that I see nothing but the difficulty. For me, it's hard. For me, it's not hard to make a sentence. It's hard to let the sentence stand because I see in it traces of everything before me, and I'm revulsed by this because of my very nature. And so I will try again and again. I have all too often failed to escape my gods. There is no god before me now that has quite the power to dominate my thinking than Bloom and Donahue, and as they extend back to people like Pater and Beckett and so on. Yes, I quite answer that, and I have no apologies for myself except to say that the effort to make one's way against belatedness is seems to me the only task in life.
I'm curious. In Extravaganza, a possibility comes up. It's not, to some extent, followed very far, but I found it thrilling. It's a book of jokes. It's a joke book. Smith and Dale, old vaudevillians, are telling in their worn-out language, worn-out jokes. But at one point, one of the jokes refers to a sight gag, and Dale objects and says that the reader, of course, can't see these things. And then the possibility comes, what if these words have no reference at all? And that possibility seemed to thrill me, as if to put the book into an outer space in which no objects but words exist, seemed to be the project in some sense.
Always a project for me. The words refer to nothing. It's why, in fact, it's a relative ease for me to make myself or appear to be at the central focus of any of the books I write. It's not really the me that I'm not pointing to any more me than I'm pointing to the table with a word that might say table or the word that might say Gordon. The effort is to make the word point beyond its reference. And that beyond is a matter of infinite enigma. One wants the mystery. One wants the acoustical and cadential and the semantic power of every kind of reference one can get. But one doesn't want the thing itself, not in those terms. The thing itself is the word. And for me, that word, as it issues from me in its layers of privacy, is the only object at hand. I'm flattered that Extravaganza has got your attention. I wish its sentences were better. I have never gone back and read the book. I really have gone back and looked at nothing. I think this not infrequently nettles persons who publish me because they expect me to read from these books. And I really find myself usually unable to do it because I see error. I see cadences that never got right. I see diction that is colossally wrong. I see absence and failure. But Extravaganza is a particular exasperation for me because just subsequent to publishing the book, I was told a joke by Leon Wieseltier at lunch, who had just read the book and said, "Well, you left out the best joke of all." And all I might say is that I'm such a shameless fellow that in the novel just completed, whose working title was The Grand Ticino, but that in fact is not its title, I must confess that I've struggled and struggled to make a space for that very joke, given that I think it's probably the grandest Beckettian joke I've ever heard. Of course, it's a joke that fits the Smith and Dale model.
I'm talking to Gordon Lish, the author most recently of Zim Zum, editor of the late literary magazine Q, and editor of books at Knopf as well. In general, are the books that you have the opportunity of editing up to the standards you would like to set for fiction in America?
I'll give you a reply that I feel is it honors the importance of that question. I teach as well as write. And I probably take my teaching more seriously than any of the activities in my life, and it has, as a prospect, always the opportunity then to stand behind what poetics I have been able to convey to my students and publish them when they have, as practitioners, come to a text that I think is worthy. As every teacher will make the claim, one's skill, one's passion, one's inescapable dominion under the impress of what a teacher so desperately wants drives one to more and more considerable exertions in the pursuit of greatness in one's students, so that I'm prepared to claim that the 15 or 20 books I have now under contract that will eventually make their way into the world via the Knopf imprint will reveal closer and closer, I think, achievements of what I would hold to be the model. I'm always willing to make the claim that what's ahead is in its way as an aesthetic principle is being espoused, stronger than what was behind. to answer the question in any more frontal terms than I already have might create for me much more enmity than I already have to receive and cope with in the world, because an insult would be delivered. I don't think it's an insolence to say that as a teacher, I seem to practice my craft with more efficiency, and that my students seem to grow more floribundant in the receipt of that efficiency. And that those students that I have chosen for the Knopf imprint, I think will show not only that they have surpassed their teacher, but they will have surpassed their predecessors who have been published by me at Knopf.
What are you particularly looking forward to, or rather, what should I be looking particularly forward to?
Well, in the most immediate future, there is a young woman whose name is Noe Holland, who has a collection of stories under the title The Spectacle of the Body, and I would direct your attention to the title story, which I think is quite without precedent. Of course, nothing is quite without precedent, but I think it's particularly strong. I cannot lay claim to having had Jack Gilbert as my student, but I'm publishing Gilbert's The Great Fires, another book of poems.
Poetry.
I'm publishing Dennis Donahue's The Old Moderns, and I hope to publish his Walter Pater, The Lover of Strange Souls. But in among my students, Sheila Cole, who's The House on R Street, will presently be seen, Brian Evanson's Altman's Tongue. There must be at least 20 texts that are on their way out whose titles I don't think it would serve to recite now because your program will air so much prior to the emergence of those titles. But if you keep your eye out for Holland's The Spectacle of the Body, particularly the title story, which I think in manuscript must be about 90 pages long, I think you'll see a rather exceptional work, one that occurs to me as being morally robust, morally difficult, morally an achievement, and one that is, from an aesthetic standpoint, superior in every way.
I'm, again, curious. Many of your books take the form of an affront. Is it possible for something to be morally serious without being affronting to morals?
No.
Really?
No.
Do you think that?
I don't think so. I think that, I suppose it depends on what you mean by moral, and I suppose I'm hoping to invoke a realm that has to do not is withdrawn entirely from the category of the political, entirely from the category of the social, but moral only in the sense of the artist's relations with himself, his relations with truth, which truth we will put in a kind of parenthesis. That is to say, his own notions of the object. And I think that a morally correct work, one whose recklessness in the vicinity of jeopardy is at an extreme, must fall upon the ears of the culture as a profound subversion, as a moral effrontery. It is very much in the manner of what we were speaking of earlier. I think if you are determined to wrest yourself away from what was, which is always the task, and to deliver to the page that which has theretofore not been on the page, you are bound to be a difficulty to everybody in sight, and maybe even to yourself.
It seems to me that within this progression, John Ashbery offers a kind of text that hadn't been before him on the page, and yet his work seems, for the most part, not an affront. It seems to have been woven from bits and threads of previous texts and to refuse them their meaning in the act of rebraiding. But it doesn't seem particularly confrontative.
Well, I think what you're hoping to get onto the table here between us is a matter of meaning, and the particular value in suppressing meaning. I want to set meaning aside in respect of the matter of creating an insult, an affront, a frontality, a kind of confrontational text. I don't find Ashbery an affront on any terms. In any terms, I don't. For an instant, I'm not unaware that in so saying, I irritated my close pals, Bloom and Donahue, who hold Ashbery at the very zenith of the literary exertion. I don't think that either one of them would see Ashbery as anything less than our most necessary poet. I have a certain prejudice in favor of other poets. Having read Ashbery as closely as I will and those other poets as closely as I wish, it's difficult for me to let myself not see Wallace Stevens, nevertheless. Though a precursor of Ashbery's, I surely imagine Ashbery would welcome, in fact, and maybe has even invited those relations to appear between the two of them. I see Wallace Stevens as a rather more frontal and, in fact, morally difficult writer than Ashbery. Why would I say this? I think Stevens was rather more private. I think we have in Stevens, the man who put before us, work of excruciating privacy, work of excruciating inwardness and solipsism. And I don't think the case can be made for Ashbery that he has done quite as satisfactorily as Stevens has in that respect. Satisfaction, in my case, being precisely that, solipsism in the extreme, the extent to which you are a case of one, for me, is the extent to which you are a case of absolute universalism, and most dangerous, most dangerous.
Well, interesting, because it seems that Ashbery's joke would, or at least by joke, I mean in the sense of extravaganza, a joke book, that there is no self in order to create a solipsism.
There is no self, no. There is no I. I think the I obtains for one while one is in the sentence. When the sentence has come to its conclusion, the I vanishes. I feel no continuity of any kind with any self. I feel no ego in me. I feel poses. I feel the pressure of poses. I feel the pressure of poses largely issuing to me out of fear. I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid of events. I'm afraid of anything exterior to myself. And so I manifest a host of poses in order to keep people at bay. It is the same with sentences. For me, they're simply distractions. They're ways of distracting the reader from who I am, what I'm about. They have a sort of incantatory, prayerful effect on myself, and I think on the handful of persons who sometimes successfully come to these sentences, as you apparently do with extravaganza.
I'm speaking to Gordon Lish, the author most recently of Zimzum, published by Pantheon. We'll continue speaking with him next week. Thank you. This is Michael Silverblatt, and you've been listening to Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. My engineer today is Scott Fritz. Join us once again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
And say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.